Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer with you on WNYC. Hello, everybody. Since Friday, obviously, parents across the country have struggled with whether and how to talk to their children about the shooting in Newtown, Connecticut. Maybe some parents are wondering, even still this morning, whether your kids are safe at school. But we know that some other parents are wondering whether their own children could ever be on the wrong side of a weapon or an incident like this. Did you see the piece posted this weekend by a Boise, Idaho-based writer named Liza Long, which ran with the headline, "I Am Adam Lanza's Mother," about her troubled young son? Liza Long wrote about her son, a 13-year-old boy with behavioral problems who sometimes gets violent, threatening her, threatening others with a knife, other things, and saying that he'll kill himself if he doesn't get his way. Liza Long doesn't know what is happening to her son, but she knows how hard it is to get help. Prison, she writes, is increasingly the only option for the mentally ill, and she's even tempted sometimes to turn in her own son for something just to get him help. But she knows also that prison really will make him worse. I want to read a little bit of this article. As of yesterday, which is the last time I looked, nearly 830,000 people have liked the story on Facebook. Nearly a quarter of a million people have shared it. Tens of thousands of comments have been added to the story on the various sites where it's been posted. There's also blowback against it for various reasons, which we'll get into. But here's just a couple of paragraphs to give you a sense of this thing that is being incredibly viral on social media right now. Quote, "I live with a son who is mentally ill. I love my son, but he terrifies me. A few weeks ago, Michael pulled a knife and threatened to kill me and then himself after I asked him to return his overdue library books. His 7 and 9-year-old siblings knew the safety plan. They ran to the car and locked the doors before I even asked them to. I managed to get the knife from Michael, then methodically collected all the sharp objects in the house into a single Tupperware container that now travels with me. Through it all, he continued to scream insults at me and threatened to kill or hurt me. That conflict ended with 3 burly police officers and a paramedic wrestling my son onto a gurney for an expensive ambulance ride to the local emergency room." So for the first part of our conversation, if you've read that or if her story, that little piece of it that I just read, Liza Long on Blue Review, by the way, is the name of the site that originally posted it. If her story resonated with you, call in. The phone lines are open for you at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to our Facebook page, Brian Lehrer, WNYC, or to our comments page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And in a few minutes, we will crowdsource a policy agenda for the mental health response that people say needs to come to the Connecticut shooting and other incidents. Joining me now are Nadine Kaslow. She is the president-elect of the American Psychological Association and vice chair of the psychology department at Emory University. And also with us, Steve Coe, CEO of Community Access, Inc. here in New York, which is a housing and peer training organization for people with mental illness. Steve Coe, Nadine Kaslow, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Steve, you were talking about it with me off the air. What's your reaction to the Liza Long article?
Well, I would encourage listeners to Google "You Are Not Adam Liza's Mother" and see a counterpoint about the issues that she brought up in terms of her viewpoint and sort of reporting inside of a story, and that there could be a lot of other issues going on. In terms of the son, and, you know, one part of that story was that he wanted to wear blue pants to school, and the dress code is black, or, you know,
there's
khaki.
A uniform at his
There's
school.
There's a uniform.
No blue.
So, you know, and the expert's on the line here, and she can comment. But it's classic. You're trying to control a situation where you feel you have no control. So there could be a lot of other issues involved in this. And to take that and say, this is what was going on in Connecticut, and, you know, what I'm dealing with is what the mother was dealing with in Connecticut is just a stretch.
Nadine, have you read the Liza Long piece?
Yes, I have indeed.
And?
Well, you know, I think it is very challenging when parents have children who are difficult, who may or may not have mental illness problems. But I think it's really critical at a time like this that we remember that it is not mental illness that causes violence. And I'm very concerned about the increased stigma that's occurring based on stories like this.
There have been, well, one of the things that put me off about the article, though in general my personal reaction to it was that it was a positive and important article, and people need to read testimonies like this from parents and others who may usually be too ashamed to come out with them. It seemed like a cry for help. I didn't like the title, I Am Adam Lanza's Mother, partly because the little that we know about Adam Lanza from press reports, and I repeat, the little that we know, because really, who knows? But what's been reported so far is that he might have had Asperger's or something on the autism spectrum, which seems very different from the kind of of violence-prone child that she was writing about with respect to her own 13-year-old son. If Lanza has been described as the ultimate withdrawn kid, this seems like the ultimate out-there kid. And, you know, so do we need, Nadine, to make a distinction here between conditions that leave you more withdrawn and conditions that leave you more regularly violence prone?
Yes, there's no question that these conditions present differently, may have different reasons for them, and have different potential outcomes. For example, there is absolutely no, and I repeat, no evidence that shows that there is any link between Asperger's or autism spectrum disorder conditions and this kind of violence. And whereas we know that there are certain kinds of mental illnesses, particularly when combined with substance abuse problems that aren't well controlled, where there may be a slight increased risk, there is absolutely none with Asperger's. I think kids who tend to be violent are going to grow up potentially more likely to grow up to be adults who are violent. People who grow up as socially isolated in general are less likely to be violent.
And Steve, I think you wanted to add to that sentiment about the stigma or something.
So when you look at the people in our program, we, you know, with Housing for 1,000 People, we serve a couple of thousand people a year. When you look at the histories that they have, by and large, there's some trauma in their background, especially for women. They've been abused. And it's not surprising that people, you know, wind up in the mental health system, wind up seeking treatment because what they've been through. And as Nadine said, there's no then connection between that and a violent outcome or becoming a violent person. We know that people who are treated violently in their as children, as Nadine said, more likely will become violent adults. And there's, you know, they're killing pets, and then they're, you know, bullying, and then that escalates.
But these conditions have labels, and maybe the labels are not altogether useless. So is it too broad a brush to paint with to say there's no relationship between mental illness and violence? Would it be more accurate to say there's no documented relationship between people on the autism Asperger spectrum and violence? There is with people diagnosed with schizophrenia?
No.
Well,
no.
Go ahead, Nadine.
Well, go ahead. What were you going to say?
I was going to say no.
Nadine, go ahead. You too.
Well, so there's absolutely no evidence with Asperger's or autism spectrum. There is a little bit of evidence with some other disorders, but that doesn't mean that the mental illness caused the violence. And I think that's the critical issue, because there's a correlation between things doesn't mean there's a cause.
So when people say we need to respond to incidents like Connecticut with gun laws, we need to respond to incidents like Connecticut with better mental health policy, better mental health access, improvements in the system, are you both cringing and saying, no, don't even bring that into this? Steve Coe, are you?
Well, there needs to be better access to care, and I get calls all the time from parents They're looking for help. There is, you know, the options are so limited. There's certainly 1-800-LIFENET, which is a helpline in New York. There's NAMI, which support groups. But when you have a situation at home that you're trying to manage on your own, the system right now is not really designed to kind of drop in to your home and help figure out what's going on and creating whatever dysfunction is occurring. So you have to take your family member to an emergency room or a hospital, or as this blogger said, you know, take him to jail. I mean, you have to take him someplace else to sort of like to start the process for getting help. And it's very, you know, disjointed. So there is some, I'm hopeful, and Nadine can chime in, with the Affordable Care Act and trying to blend together mental health care and physical care, and that when you go to a doctor, you go to a pediatrician, and the pediatrician is looking at the broad range of issues going on in a child's life, and you don't get sent off to another specialist, or the other specialist might be next door. We have a chance to kind of catch some of this stuff at a much earlier stage.
But Nadine, when we look at the string of killers who make the news after all these incidents, Holmes in the Colorado shooting, Jared Loughner, this guy in Connecticut, a pattern seems to be that they flipped out, to use a colloquial term. Would you say that these people, these individuals, I think everybody gets the idea you don't want to stereotype or stigmatize people with various kinds of mental illness, any kind of mental illness, as somebody who is therefore more likely to become violent. On the other hand, the people who do these kinds of things seem to be mentally ill. And so if you accept that notion, does that suggest a response needed at some level of policy?
Well, I think there are a couple comments I want to make. First of all, I don't think people just, quote, flip out. I really think that there are warning signs, that there are indicators that people are really, really struggling. Unfortunately, we may not notice them at the time, but we look back in retrospect and we can often see indicators. So it's very rare that someone, quote, flips out or snaps, as people are saying. I do think that we do need many more mental health resources. I think we need a lot more resources in our school systems right now. I think we need a lot more prevention programs. I think that we need better ways to get access in various parts of our community, including community programs that come into the home. Mental health services have been cut back significantly over the years. And when we took people out of the hospitals, which was a very good move, the idea was we were going to provide them more resources in the community. But that really hasn't been what's gone on. I agree that the Affordable Care Act offers us some hope in certain ways, in terms of, as you mentioned, the blending of physical and mental health care. But unfortunately, I think for some of the people we're talking about here, they're not even likely to go in for their physical health care. And so we're going to have to find more creative ways to reach out to them and their loved ones, not just the people we're concerned about, but their families as well.
Right. A little more from Liza Long's I Am Adam Lanza's Mom article. By day three, describing another incident about her 13-year-old son, he was calm, my sweet boy again, all apologies and promises to get better. I've heard those promises for years. I don't believe them anymore. On the intake form under the question, what are your expectations for treatment, I wrote, I need help. And I do. This problem is too big for me to handle on my own. Sometimes there are no good options, so you just pray for grace and trust that in hindsight, it will all make sense. Daphne in Larchmont, you're on WNYC. Hello, Daphne.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. When I read the Liza Long piece, I knew the kid. Not that specific one, but a friend of mine who lives across the country has twins, and one of them exhibited many of these same symptoms or problems. He would, in the middle of a Home Depot, just absolutely go nuts and swear and be threatening to his parents. And more than once, they had to call the police to take care of him because they are not big enough to hold him anymore. And they had to go through telling all the police in the area, okay, this is my son, this is his problem. he is on the Asperger spectrum. So there are plenty of kids out there. I don't know if there are plenty, but there's at least another kid out there. And parents, I heard my friend say, I am afraid.
What did your friend want, if anything, from society or a mental health system that wasn't available to her?
Some way to help her son get better. She loves him and wants him to be better and wants not to have to worry about him and wants not to have to worry about the people around him.
Definitely.
And saw lots and lots of doctors, that's what she wanted.
Thank you for your call. Jamie in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC.
Hey,
hi, Jamie.
I guess I would say I'm Adam Lanza's brother. I had a twin brother who passed away 4 years ago. He died in my bathtub of a brain aneurysm. Mm. My mother tried and tried and tried to get him help. And unfortunately, because of the system, the way the system is designed, because he was an adult, he had to consent. And he wasn't in any, you know, state of mind to consent to get help. So I think there's definitely a lot that needs to be done with the mental health system. I mean, that's obviously a mental illness if you're going to go and you commit those types of crimes. My mother had to hide all the knives in the house.
I'm sorry that you all had to go through that and for the loss of your brother. Are you suggesting that it should be easier than it is to commit someone against their will?
It should be much easier because unless he gets arrested, they couldn't put him into any facility. He had to be arrested or something. And he would go outside and just smack people for no reason, beat people up. And because everyone knew him, no one would do anything. We all, you know, people understood his illness. And, you know, it was just tough. I mean, we struggled a lot. I used to even pray to God that he would take him rather than to see him in the street. I found him one time. He became homeless and by choice. And I would look around for him for days, and I found him in Central Park looking, you know.
Looking around.
Looking through the garbage for food. And this is my twin brother, so it was a tough.
Jamie, I really appreciate your candor on this. And so Nadine Kaslow is president-elect of the American Psychological Association. How do you react to these couple of stories?
Well, obviously these stories are very, very sad, and my heart goes out to the people that we're listened to and to the families and to the children and young adults who are suffering. I think that we do need more family-centered mental health care. And that would mean that families would have better ways to get assistance for their loved ones. I couldn't agree with you more that the system makes it difficult, if not impossible, particularly when they become over age, to get adequate care and attention. And that doesn't necessarily mean just commitment, but even outpatient services. And so I think there are many policy changes that must be made so that people who need her deserve and can receive the quality of services is best for them.
And Steve Coe, as CEO of Community Access, you're in the business of providing one of these set of services because as a housing program and peer training organization for people with mental illness, you're trying to set up a system that serves some of the people who are now too old to be treated as children, right?
Right. So what happens now is somebody will have a crisis. They'll wind up in an emergency room or a hospital, have a horribly traumatic experience there, sometimes handcuffed, medicated, and they don't want to go through that again. And so this sort of treatment resistance becomes really resistance against that experience that they've had. So next week, in partnership with the city, we're setting up a new crisis treatment program that'll be a place that people can go instead of an emergency room. It'll be a building in the community. The staff are all people who have been in emergency rooms and hospitals themselves, specially trained to work with people in a crisis. And a key component of it will be a connection with the family. Another feature of going to a hospital is you are cut off from the outside world. You're being treated by professionals and then sent back out. This program will link crisis services trained to work with families and the individual as a package, and linking also to physical health, because there's a lot of underlying physical health issues that then manifest themselves in, you know, lack of sleep will produce psychosis, all kinds of things. And so instead of like saying, what's this diagnosis this person having, what kind of medication do they need as a first instance, let's let them sleep for a while, make sure they eat, and then we'll start a conversation mm-hmm. about what is going on in their life. And then back that up, we'll have a warm line that people can call and families can call on an ongoing basis. So the once they touch us, we'll stay with them for months and months until we kind of start to figure out what's going on with the whole situation.
A warm line is cooler than a hotline.
Yes.
We will continue this conversation in a minute with part two. And here's part two as we turn the page with our same guests, Nadine Kaslow from Emory University, President-elect of the American Psychological Association, and Steve Coe, CEO of Community Access, a housing and peer training organization for people with mental illness here in New York. But now we're going to crowdsource the policy agenda. So we've heard a few pieces of it. If you're hanging on the phones to add to this list, stay there. Otherwise, we'll clear your line and we'll let other people come in. If there's going to be a policy response to things like Connecticut, what should it be? If we're not only going to talk about guns but also talk about services for people at risk, what should be on that policy agenda? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Call us now only with that. And we'll take your calls and your comments, too, from our webpage, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. You can post there if the lines are full. And we'll continue this conversation in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Now we're going to crowdsource a mental health policy action list at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, with Nadine Kaslow, President-elect of the American Psychological Association, and Steve Coe, CEO of Community Access, a housing and peer training organization for people with mental illness here in New York. And Candida in New Rochelle, you're on WNYC. Hello, Candida.
Oh, hi, Brian. Thanks so much for taking my call. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
My thought in terms of broadly, I'm a child psychiatrist, and I think that we have to be looking at much bigger and broader developmental and mental health support in schools starting very young. I work with a lot of preschoolers who have problems with regulating themselves, just like in the Liza Long article. And these kids get treated with crime and punishment and are not identified as having developmental or psychiatric needs, and that just makes things worse and worse and worse. So we really need a broader approach to these kids and understanding that these are developmental concerns, and we just need a bigger presence of specialists and support in the schools from very early on. And there's a lot of resistance to that, I think, even with, for example, screening for depression in college students. That was highly resisted by many people on the right.
Routine. Now, there's a controversial proposal, I think. Routine screening for college students for depression?
I believe it is critical. I believe it's critical. I think, you know, we look at the suicide rates on campus, how hard it is for kids to access services, how hard it is for kids to identify when they are having mental health issues. It's a medical concern. Why are we not screening similarly as we do for all other medical issues? I think it's a real huge missing piece and could provide so much help to children and families to be proactive in this area instead of reactive.
Candida, thank you very much. Carol in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello. Carol, you there?
This is Carol.
Hi. Yeah, it's you.
Hi. I thought you said Karen. So thank you for your show. One of the hallmarks of really serious major mental disorders is a very low level of functioning over time in adulthood. And when that happens, and individuals have gone to see psychiatrists, often they're put on a permanent disability, SSD. And one of the things that I think needs to be addressed as a policy issue is that, as far as I know, when there's a permanent disability, there's nothing that is mandated for that person to stay in treatment, to get any treatment. They can refuse treatment, and yet they're getting government money because they can't function in society.
So Social Security Disability, SSD, if people are on that for mental health issues, require that they get treatment.
Well, that would be what I would hope for because, it's other things are mandated. And in fact, if the government is saying that you are so disabled and, you know, doctors, social workers have to apply for an individual, so disabled that you cannot be gainfully employed, then that mm-hmm. requires some contact
ongoing
on a regular
assessment.
Basis.
Right. Carol, thank you very much. So that's another one in addition to routine screening of college students and more support for diagnostics in early childhood. Leslie in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Leslie.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Okay, thank you.
I have a brother. We're both in our early 60s now, and he's right now under the care of a trust attorney in my parents' home, who are both deceased in Massachusetts. But I wanted to mention that because he is mentally ill and does not think he's mentally ill, he self-medicates with marijuana and alcohol. So he was picked up several times by and put into the criminal justice system, but there was a forced hospitalization program in Massachusetts where the person who has been picked up DWI has to go through a counseling program for 8 weeks for alcohol abuse. Now, I think one of the things that was remiss about this, you know, excellent policy that Massachusetts has for alcohol abuse, they could have screened him for mental illness and had some excellent counseling going on for the reason why he was medicating and on alcohol. And I think that would have helped my mother out quite a bit, who, you know, absolutely took care of him until her death.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's another angle that society could look at.
Thank you very much. Well, let me get our guests' reactions to these three. And Steve Coe, that last caller, makes me think of your organization, which, again, if we're talking policy now,
right.
What I know was founded in response to the great deinstitutionalization of the 1960s and 70s. And people who are old enough will remember that there was a big outcry after the Willowbrook Institution in Staten Island and others were revealed to have such horrid conditions that then there was a deinstitutionalization movement for, you know, the maximum freedom for people with mental illness. But the halfway house system that was supposed to replace it, organizations like yours, never really developed in a robust enough way, right?
Right. I think that let me just respond to that last point.
Sure.
Because after the dismantling of the mental health or hospital system, I mean, what's grown is the criminalization of people with mental health diagnoses.
They're being reinstitutionalized,
yes.
Except in prisons instead of hospitals.
So there are opportunities, and there's things called mental health courts, so that when somebody, because of their behavior, touches the criminal justice system, you can then go to a special court and a judge is involved, and this idea of not forced treatment but a connection to a treatment, some kind of a treatment program that the person is involved in helping design themselves for what they think is going to make their life different, is then supervised by a judge. And they have to come back into the court on a routine basis. Otherwise, their charges would be escalated. So that is – It's pretty small,
mm-hmm.
But it's very successful. And the other caller about people getting onto disability and then sort of not being required to do anything. And in fact, I think it's a good point that there is we've created an underclass, and it is you're disabled, and then if you do work, you lose. And when you get SSI, you also get Medicaid, so you got health insurance.
Mm.
You're living on $3 a day, which is nothing. You spend more on a cup of coffee. But you get this valuable health insurance package, and that's what people try to protect. And if you work, if you earn anything, you're at risk of losing that, or at least that's how it's perceived by the people on SSI. So,
Nadine, any reactions to our callers? Routine screening for mental health for college students because there's a high suicide rate, anything?
Yes, so I want to comment on the first caller. I could not agree more with her. I think routine screening for stress and mental health difficulties in colleges is critical. I think there are some very effective programs right now to do that, but I don't think screening is enough. If you find out there are problems, you also have to have the resources available to provide adequate mental health services for people who screen positive or like they're having difficulties. I think if it's done routinely, it helps to destigmatize it, and it just makes it part of the culture. I also really agree about programming in the schools, starting with our very young children, even in preschool, and moving our way through elementary school, middle school, and high school. The more the services are integrated where people live, whether that be in their primary care settings or in their schools or in their religious organizations, the more likely people are to avail themselves of those services.
Nadine Kaslow, president-elect of the American Psychological Association. Steve Coe, CEO of Community Access, a housing and peer training organization for people with mental illness. Let's hear from a few more listeners as we crowdsource a mental health policy action agenda. Peter in Livingston, you're on WNYC. Hello, Peter.
Yes, hi there. It's me?
Hi. It's you, yeah, hi.
Yeah, hi there. Thanks for taking my call. Listen, the counseling and the services and the treatment, of course, very, very important, no question. But I want to add something a little beyond the box here. Don't we need more research into neuroscience and the brain to find out what's going on? Because I think it's pretty clear a lot of neuroscience research is showing that there's some kind of disorder or dysfunction or lesion or problem or malfunction of some sort in the brain physically in a lot of cases that causes these mental illnesses, and we need to know more about that. There's not enough being done to find out what could be going on physically in the brain that's causing these kind of violent behaviors, antisocial behaviors, psychoses, mental illnesses of whatever kind. We need more research being done to find out so that we mm-hmm. could hopefully get better treatments and better preventions even, or better screenings.
Peter, thank you. Serious brain research. Point taken. In fact, I think Alyssa in Princeton wants to elaborate on that notion. Right, Alyssa?
Yeah, hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I'm the research manager for the Juvenile Bipolar Research Foundation. I could not agree with the last caller more. I think it's really important for people out there to know that, you know, early identification and treatment help is wonderful, but until we start having effective treatments because we actually know what's going on, there's still going to be a lot of heartbreak, hand-wringing, and wasted money and lives. So NIMH, National Institute of Mental Health, has recently started a huge new research initiative because now is the time that we're finally getting into live brains and understanding how they work and how they create behavior. Mm-hmm. All these diagnoses that are, you know, that are tossed about and we just don't know how to treat them, it's because they're defined based on 30-year-old concepts.
Right. And so, and listen, I'm going to leave it there because the idea is clear from the two of you, you and the previous caller, more research into the brain and behavior. Teresa in Westchester, you're on WNYC. What would you propose?
Hi, I was thinking of diagnosing and identifying it's only part of the problem when the community doesn't accept these people, and children and adults, especially children, are isolated and they have no friends and they have no relationships. I think we need a public health campaign that destigmatizes mental illness and all issues, ADD, ADHD, being on the spectrum, because the community needs to welcome these children and have playdates with them and sit next to them at lunch. And public health campaigns have done so much to change behavior from smoking to recycling, that a massive campaign to say this is a problem we all need to accept together. You can't legislate compassion, but we can certainly teach people that they need to open their hearts and their minds to these children and these people.
Thank you very much. Louise in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. I'm Canadian and I'm living in Manhattan. And the Canadian government puts guns and mental health together. My daughter lives in Toronto and got her gun permit recently for skeet shooting. But she told me the procedure she went through took about 6 weeks. She had to go to school to learn all about guns and owner responsibility. There was an oral and written exam, 80% to pass. You had to show the instructor you knew how to handle the guns, and I'm sure they were observing her at the time. Then, after that, the police call your family, friends, and boss to get an idea of your personality, mental health, and your relationships. No permit is given if you're divorced or fired within 2 years. There are no sales online. The license is for 5 years and has to be renewed. No concealed weapon permit. If you go to a gun show, you must have a permit. And then the high schools make you do 1 hour a week of volunteer work in order to graduate. So that might be something worth the U.S. looking into.
That is serious business, and that is something for a segment we'll do next hour, too, on gun policy. But Steve Coe, if she's right, from a mental health standpoint, that is a pretty low bar of defining somebody at a mental health risk for gun violence if they won't give you a gun permit after 2 years of being divorced or being fired.
Yes. So other thing in my background, I was in the Army, and what she the caller just described as the process for learning about a weapon and using a weapon is what happens when you are in the Army. And what you also go through is a battery of tests, and they want to see how you think and what your character is like. And so these are reasonable things. And when you think about how hard it is to get a license to drive a car and what you have to do for that, and then you can just go get a weapon without any kind of questions asked, it's an amazing.
Anything you two professionals want to put on the table as we come to our conclusion here with respect to crowdsourcing this mental health policy action agenda?
Well, Nadine? I would like to comment on two of the prior people who called in. I absolutely agree that we need more neuroscience research, but I don't think it should stop with neuroscience research. I think we need to look at this much more broadly. Some things have to do with the brain. Other things have to do with an interaction between what's going on in people's brains and the environment. Some things have to do with the larger community. And so I think if we're going to talk about a research agenda, it needs to be a comprehensive research agenda that not only helps us understand, but helps us develop and implement and disseminate more effective interventions. That's my comment on the research.
Okay.
In terms of the public health campaign,
real quick,
the time is now. The time is now, and we must mobilize our resources more than we ever have to move forward an effective public health campaign related to mental health and destigmatizing mental illness.
Steve Coe, what's at the top of your list? Because when we talk about guns, we can easily list the big three agenda items out there, I think, for reformers: an assault weapons ban, an extended capacity magazine ban, closing the gun show loophole on background checks. What's at the top of your list for mental health agenda that people should have as readily on their lips?
I think that this idea that people are resistant to services is false, and that we have to do a much better job of having a range of services and bringing peers into the workforce so that the first time you touch the system, you get a compassionate response and an understanding response, and somebody's trying to really begins a conversation with you before, figuring out what medication you're supposed to be on.
You know, the Daily Beast, in an article about the movie theater massacre last summer, pointed out that when NATO leaders met in Chicago around the same time, the biggest demonstration in town that week was not targeted at them or world affairs, but was outside the home of Mayor Rahm Emanuel over the closings of mental health clinics. And so when we have this discussion that is triggered by a mass rampage in Connecticut, I think what we're hearing from our guests and our callers is that all these things would improve the quality of life of ordinary people with mental illness and ordinary families in ordinary circumstances, and that's what gets lost in the shuffle. So I'm glad we had this conversation with Nadine Kaslow, professor and vice chair of the psychology department at Emory University, president-elect of the American Psychological Association, and Steve Coe, CEO of Community Access, a housing and peer training organization for people with mental illness here in New York. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and coming up next, The deadline has arrived for states to decide whether they'll set up health insurance exchanges to sell policies under Obamacare. Some, like New York, will. Some, like New Jersey, won't. We'll compare what it means for the uninsured in each.